The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
Many night shift workers get less than 5.5 hours out of every 24. If you did that to a political prisoner, that would be considered torture.
Russell Foster, neuroscientist extraordinaire, fan of the science of sleep and one of the organisers of this year's Cheltenham Science Festival. He drops in to discuss circadian rhythms and an ambitious sleep experiment that requires your participation. Also on the programme...
We want to look at very successful economies, like, for example, some of the Scandinavian countries, where the population is very sparse, and yet they're extremely innovative and have very high quality of living.
Nobel laureate Sir John Sulston. He's the man behind a report for the Royal Society, People and the Planet. This looks at the thorny issue of global population and its environmental impacts. We'll also go through some of this week's news, including a surprising statement from Harvard University and 50 years of the UK in space. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Russell Foster is a neuroscientist, an expert in sleep, and a friend of the podcast. He's interested in making sure we all get a sound and good amount of sleep. He's also interested, by the way, in what happens if we don't sleep enough. To that end, he's teamed up with his German colleague, Professor Till Röhneberg from the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. They want to explore and contrast the different sleep patterns of the British and the Germans. Russell came into the studio to tell me more about his new research. I started by asking him about what we know from a scientific perspective about sleep. So, what is sleep?
Well, you'd think that defining sleep would be really easy, but it isn't. I mean, many people think that sleep is essentially a suspension of brain activities. But in fact, some areas of the brain during sleep are more active than during the wake state. So I suppose, generally, behaviourally, it's a reduction in awareness. It's a suspension of one's physical activities. And beyond that, I think it's actually rather difficult to define.
So sleep is not a lack of something. It's actually turns out to be a completely different mental state.
Yes,
a sort of subconscious thing. And yeah. Describe to us then who looks at this and what's the sort of need to look at it? I mean, it's just something we do, surely.
Yeah, I mean, of course, a third of our lives will be spent asleep, and a medical student in a 5-year training perhaps will get one lecture on it, and it'll be about the EEG, the electrical activity recorded from the skull. But in fact, that really hasn't informed particularly our understanding of the mechanisms of sleep. So if we think about the neuroscience of sleep, there are multiple brain structures, and almost all of the neurotransmitters in the brain are involved in sleep at some level. And it's almost like a switch on and a switch off. And there are various structures in the brain, for example, the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei, amazing bit in the anterior hypothalamus, which has been defined as the sleep switch. Turn that on, and you turn the ascending arousal system off, which sends us into this sleep state. But all of those neurotransmitters and those brain structures are in turn being regulated by the body clock, these circadian rhythms, which we also have a pretty good understanding of now, this bit of the hypothalamus, the suprachiasmatic nuclei. Individual SCN neurons are able to generate a 24-hour oscillation, and we can now associate 12 to 14 genes and their protein products in the generation of those 24-hour oscillations. So that feeds into the timing of sleep. Then we have the intuitive part of sleep, which is the homeostatic drive, the sleep pressure. The greater, the longer you've been awake, the greater the sleep pressure. So all of these things are feeding in to generate the sleep-wake pattern that many of us experience every night. What's it for?
Well, that was my next question. What is it for? Because evolutionarily, it must be very important, because otherwise you're lying in a prone state next to some tigers that can possibly eat you.
Yeah. The consensus seems to be that memory consolidation is a really critical component of sleep. So during the day, lots of information is coming in, and you, in a sense, have to make an immediate response. But then when you're asleep, the brain is processing that information and making decisions about whether to send short-term memories into long-term memory. And it's also doing other things as well. So, for example, one's ability to come up with innovative solutions to complex tasks is enormously enhanced by sleep. Beautiful studies that have been undertaken in Germany have looked at the impact of one night of sleep on the ability to come up with solutions to mathematical problems, for example. And there was a 70% increase in one's ability to come up with novel solutions. So you can get by with very little sleep if you just want to do more of the same, basically routine, non-thinking tasks. But if you want to come up with novel solutions to complex problems, sleep is a vital part of it.
You're doing a lot of thinking when you're asleep.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose the analogy has been that all this information is coming in during the day, and it's a bit like lots of bits of jigsaw puzzles. And what the brain is trying to do is decide where those bits go. And so it's sort of placing them in usually the right place, but also sometimes in a bizarre place which doesn't quite fit. And some people have thought that what that is a dream, bizarre associations which are not laid down into long-term memory, but it's something that you will experience if you wake up. And it's part of the brain processing of that information.
And for your physical health, what is sleep doing for that?
Oh, it's just where to start. I mean, so many aspects of health are now linked to sleep. Probably because an absence of sleep activates the stress axis. And we do know that elevated stress is associated with a whole raft of problems. One, for example, is reduced immunity. You know, one night of no sleep and your immune system, elements of the immune system, such as natural killer cells, their efficacy is down by 28%. And we know, for example, in night shift workers who have sustained and disrupted sleep, that they are more prone to certain cancers, colorectal cancer, breast cancer in long-term night shift workers in the nursing environment have been well documented. So there's those sorts of health issues. Metabolic problems are now turning out to be a really interesting association with sleep disruption. So, for example, Chicago group, Evan Kauter, has shown that restricted sleep, only 4 hours of sleep a night for 7 days in healthy young males has elevated ghrelin levels. Now, ghrelin are these hunger hormones, up by 28%. Carbohydrate consumption in that group was up by 35 to 40%. And the satiation hormone, leptin, was down by 17%. So no wonder you find that diabetes 2 and obesity is also associated with sustained and disrupted sleep.
So with that increase in potential cancers, for example, you mentioned with night shift workers, there's a conundrum there. Surely they are still getting sleep, but at the wrong time, obviously. And when I say the wrong time, they're sleeping in the daytime rather than the nighttime. Is that a risk factor too, sleeping at the wrong time?
Well, you see, you've made the assumption that they're getting enough sleep, but at the wrong time.
Right.
Well, this is the problem. We go back to the neuroscience of sleep. So the homeostatic pressure has built up. You know, you've worked overnight and you're desperately tired. And so you go home and you want to sleep. But the body clock, which is set by the light-dark cycle, says, hang on, it's daytime. You should be awake. And so these two drivers of sleep are not in sync. And so the quality and the duration of sleep is usually very short. Many night shift workers get less than 5.5 hours out of every 24. And that, if you did that to a political prisoner, that would be considered torture.
Let's talk about the quality of sleep now then. What's a good quality sleep? How long is it? What happens to your brain during that time?
Well, sleep has been described using the electroencephalogram, and you go through a series of stages from quiet rest, four stages of non-REM sleep, non-rapid eye movement sleep, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 3 and 4 are associated with slow wave sleep and things like memory consolidation, for example. Then you ramp very rapidly back up from 4, 3, 2, 1 into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, and you can recognize this in a partner or indeed your dog by this extremely sort of rapid eye movement during that sleep. And at that stage, in fact, you're basically paralyzed. And the argument there is that you're not able physically to act out what's going on, some of your dreams, for example. And there are conditions where that paralysis doesn't kick in during REM sleep, and people have murdered their partners or done extraordinary and bizarre things, which we perhaps shouldn't go into, but it's worth going online.
Is that where sleepwalking comes from?
No,
well?
You see, that's very different. Sleepwalking will go on during non-REM sleep, when you're not paralysed, but it's during REM sleep you suffer this paralysis. And then that will be one cycle that can take around about 60 to 90 minutes. And then you go down again from REM sleep, 1, 2, 3, 4, non-REM, and then you bounce back. What you tend to find is that there's more slow wave, deep sleep, during the first part of the night, and more REM sleep during the second part of the night. And ideally, you wake from REM sleep, and that's why you may remember your dreams.
So over what's a good amount of sleep for an average person?
The average is around about 7 to 8 hours, but that's very much an average. It's been argued that in the recent past we slept significantly longer. Even until the 1950s, it's thought that many people were getting 8 to 9 hours or more of sleep every night.
I suppose it also depends on how old you are.
Yes, all of those factors, how old you are, how much you've drunk, just everything. But I think what individuals need to do is listen to their body. If you are feeling tired during the day and you're making mistakes and you're feeling irritable and nodding off, then clearly you're not getting enough sleep. If you are utterly dependent upon an alarm clock to get you out of bed in the morning, you're not getting enough sleep. And the really interesting, I think, indicator is what happens at the weekend. When you're not working, when do you wake up? When would you naturally wake up? And most people will wake up much later at the weekend than they will during the week. And that, again, indicates that they're not getting enough sleep.
Now, we talked last time about something called sleep hygiene.
Yes.
Which is a fantastic phrase. And this is the idea of what you're saying, what you just said now, which is that listen to your body, work out how much you're sleeping, because actually it can have effects throughout the day. Yeah. If you find yourself waking up late and then drinking coffee to keep yourself awake, I mean, that you're medicating yourself all day long, yeah, essentially, which you can fix by just sleeping properly at some point. Tell us a bit about the survey you're running, which you're hoping to collect some data from members of the public about their sleep habits.
Well, my mate Till Renneberg at the University of Munich has produced a really brilliant short online sleep questionnaire. And there's lots of different sorts of sleep questionnaires, but what he's done is two things. First of all, he's made it very simple. He's made it online, so you just log on and fill out the questions. But also, what he's taken into account are work days versus free days. And that hasn't really been taken into account before. And as we just discussed, you're going to see big differences on work days versus free days. And so he can use that information then to get a really good assessment of one's genuine sleeping habits. And what it does is define the time you get up, the time you go to bed, and your sleep duration. And also, there's a bunch of other questions associated with other sorts of habits that you may have, whether you're a regular coffee user or alcohol user and other things as well.
Why is lack of sleep seen as quite a good thing, especially in big business contexts? I mean, Margaret Thatcher famously only slept for 4 hours a night, and everyone thought, wow, well, how that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, why is it such a good thing, given the list of potential problems that you've outlined in the last 10 minutes?
I think it's extraordinary that the way we simply marginalise sleep. I mean, you know, as I think we discussed before, it's a sort of illness that needs a cure.
Yeah.
And I think it's been this fundamental failure to appreciate what sleep is providing.
Well, people think of it's a wasted time.
Absolutely. The brain is shut down. You know, my God, you're wasting a third of your life. But actually, you're not. And I think if our bankers and our politicians embrace sleep a little more, then the decisions they make would be significantly improved.
What are you hoping that the survey will produce? Is it going to be fed into genuine scientific research?
Oh, absolutely. Till has managed to collect the sleep habits of around about 70,000 German individuals, and some really interesting data is emerging. So, for example, we're beginning to, on the basis of the survey, tease apart some of the social factors that are associated with sleep, some of the environmental factors, and potentially some of the genetic factors as well. And what we thought would be fascinating is to compare the German population, where we have a very large number of individuals, 70,000 people, with the Brits, where we only have so far 1,000 people. So part of what we want to do is encourage the Brits to sign on, fill up the sleep questionnaire, and then we can start to compare. There's all this sort of anecdotal stuff, like the Germans are a more sort of regimented group of individuals, and so they're going to get up earlier. And then there's this sort of idea that the Brits will get up later, but actually work for longer. All this is really hand-waving. The other thing is, of course, is that in the UK, there's a broader racial mix. There's a greater mixing pot of genetic types. Will that also influence the sleep habits? We've no idea. So I think it will be a genuinely interesting study to compare environmental factors, for example, sunrise, genetic factors potentially, and social factors.
I think that nothing's going to get you more people in a bit of competition, though, especially between the Brits and the Germans.
Well, I have to say, I mean, of course, Till is perhaps my best friend in science, and we conceive this in the way of thinking, a bit of rival would be quite good.
Well, you need to sort of define a good result. If the Germans are sleeping 8 hours, is it better if we sleep seven or nine?
I think this is what's up for discussion. I mean, part of the fun thing at Cheltenham will be, we'll have this data, hopefully, and then we can start to think about how to interpret it. I mean, are we doing better than we thought or not?
So you mentioned Cheltenham there. That's the Cheltenham Science Festival in June, the middle of June. So you'll be presenting the results, will you, from these surveys?
Absolutely. And this is why we need as many people to sign on and get as large a data set as possible.
Okay. Russell, thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Thanks to Russell Foster there. As he said, the more people who take part in the survey, the better. It's confidential and takes about 5 minutes. Just go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly and you'll find a link to the survey from the blog. Go on, do it just before you go to bed this evening. Here with me to discuss this week's science news are Robin McKee, the science editor of The Observer, and Ian Sample, science correspondent at The Guardian. Welcome to you both, chaps. Ian, we'll start with you. Harvard University, the richest, one of the most prominent universities in the world, can't afford its academic journals. Tell us the story.
Or more like it doesn't want to afford them and doesn't feel it should be paying the prices that it is paying. So Harvard is it has one of the richest libraries on the planet. And it has put a memo around to all of its faculty, which is more than 2,000 teaching and research staff, saying that it finds that the major publishers are charging such price hikes, are giving such price hikes that it's become financially unsustainable, and that they want faculty to consider putting their articles in open access journals. And if they're on journal boards, a lot of these academics serve on editorial boards of journals, they say if that journal can't move towards an open access kind of publishing model, then to consider resigning. So they're really trying to mobilize their faculty to get away from their reliance on these major journal publishers that are charging them what they feel is far too much money.
These are strong words. How much money does Harvard spend on journal subscriptions?
Well, I don't know the total subscription, but they refer to prices that are charged by certain large journal publishers as totaling $3.5 million a year. And that is actually reasonably typical for a big research library in the UK. Now, you can say Harvard has an awful lot of money, which it does, but that doesn't mean that it should be sort of paying over the odds. And clearly the library committee feels that what they are being asked to pay for a lot of journals is far higher than they should be paying. There are other issues in here where a lot of journal publishers bundle journals together. So if you want to get a really important journal that everybody wants to read, you have to buy it with a couple of other less important journals that no one particularly reads. And so there's some sort of not particularly useful behavior going on here that the university wants to try and get away from.
It's an interesting sort of addition to the sort of ongoing debate that's been going on for years now about access to scientific literature. We've written about it. Many people are arguing that scientists should perhaps only publish in taxpayer-funded scientists should at least publish their work in places where anyone who wants to do anything with that result can do anything they want with it without having to pay to access the information. We've paid for the researcher's time, we've paid for the researcher's project, so why can't we have the results for free? And the $3.5 million that you mentioned, for example, to publishing companies seems quite a lot. Because most of that a lot of that would be going to profits for these international companies. It's always been the research librarians, I suppose, who are at the sharp end of this, because they're the ones negotiating these enormous contracts and paying the prices. For the academic at a university, wherever you are, you could just log into your local library computer and it's just there, right? I mean, it's going to take the librarians to sort of start, sounds really odd, this, it's going to take the librarians to man the barricades a bit.
Well, what's unlikely profession to do
well,
that?
Well, exactly. But they're the ones who are, really feeling this.
Yeah, you're quite right. Yeah.
I think what's been the problem historically, though, is that this has been seen as a research a library budget issue. And so the academics go about their daily lives doing the research, firing up their computers, getting access to the journals they want. And it's the journals who the journals and the librarians that have the awkward relationship. What the library at Harvard is now trying to do very sensibly is to mobilize the academics and say, actually, you are the guys who have the ability to make an impact here. And you are the guys who are going to be affected if we start cancelling subscriptions. Now, some of these things haven't played out very well before. When in Germany, when one of the Max Planck Institutes tried to cancel subscriptions, the academics revolted against the library to get them to restock and sign those contracts again and get the journals back. So it's trying to move that battlefield away from the librarians and the journals towards academics and the journals.
Robin, is it always going to be the case that academics are much more interested in themselves than other people spending money on their behalf to try and access to information? I mean, these guys want to publish in Nature and Science, which costs money.
Yes, I mean, they're there to get the prestige, and that matters in the career. A career matters in publication and cited papers. So they have to have some source for those papers. I thought it's interesting about the Harvard story is that the Harvard Library Committee are trying to find a different way to provide those papers. It's not just doing what Max Planck did and then just stop it, which is just going to infuriate academics. It's passing the ball back to the academics and say, find another system, one that's a lot cheaper. And who knows, you know, they might be successful.
With the web, you'd hope that institutional repositories would become easier, the actual cost of publishing would be easier. Let's not go into the whole open access debate. We'll do that another time. We'll do that another time. Robin, let's move on to some real science. Tell us about the solar orbiter.
Well, the solar orbiter is interesting on two levels. One, it's a very interesting project in its own right. The European Space Agency has just signed a contract with Astrium UK to build this satellite. It's about £245 million at current prices. And the aim is really to take over from SOHO, which is the
Heliospheric Observatory.
Thank you. Put me out of my misery there. Which is coming to the end of its life. And it will do is orbit very, very close to the sun. I mean, it's something about 40 million miles. And that's closer than Mercury. And it will not just look at the sort of sides of the sun that we see. It will at some points look at the poles of the sun, which are not often seen, and it will study the way the heliosphere behaves, how it impacts on space near the sun, and how it impacts upon the weather in the UK. Studying the sun, you know, we're utterly dependent on our lives on the sun, and studying it couldn't be much more important, you would have thought.
It gets closer to the sun, it's closer than anything else to the sun. Mm. There's a worry here. Isn't it going to melt?
It is. Protecting it is going to be a big problem. And if it doesn't, if it just stays where it is and hovers, one side would heat to about 500 degrees centigrade. So they've got to take various measures to protect it from that, which is in itself an interesting technological challenge. It's got to, you know, it's close to these huge solar eruptions and sunspots that determine, have such an influence on the weather in this country and in the world. I'm sorry,
just in this country.
Just this country. It's more important in Britain. It's a British broadcast, after all.
Well, also given that how important weather is to the general conversation in this country, I think that's right. Spending £250 million quid to work out, you know, whether it's going to be sunny the next day.
But the other thing is its symbolic importance of this, because the signature was dated 50. It was last week. It was 50 years since the launch of the first satellite, Ariel 1. So we've had 50 years of British space science, and it has a symbolic value. It's an interesting what Britain has done in space in the last 50 years. In many, we've done some of the best space science there is, but we've completely made a shambles of getting there and being independent space power. We threw it away.
Well, on this issue, so the 26th of April was the 50th anniversary of Ariel 1, as you say. Ariel 1 was the first in a series of test satellites that went up into space to look at the outer atmosphere of the Earth. And it was the beginning of possibly a UK space power. We had our own launch capability, all sorts of things. We gave that up eventually, threw it away. 50 years later, what would you say is the sort of position of Britain in space. NASA is the superpower. Russia has been a superpower for a long time. China and India are coming along.
France. Look at
France. France, Germany. In the European Space Agency, it's France and Germany really that
and,
are the...
And Italy more than the UK.
Where's the UK in all this? And well, let's put a couple of cards on the table. The UK is incredibly good at satellites.
Yes.
Especially small satellites.
And very good environmental scientists, Earth observation satellites.
Basic science. We're involved in virtually all of the major NASA missions in the last 50 years. Fantastic missions such as Cassini-Huygens, where it was British software and British parachutes that made sure that the Huygens probe landed on Titan and found these incredible methane seas.
Yes.
So you know we're not rubbish at this stuff.
No, our scientists are absolutely superb at it. The trouble is that we never got ourselves in a position where we could direct the missions because we had an independent launch capability, which always leads gives you power. I mean, the interesting example is Blue Streak, which we was never failed. The launch there was never a failure of a Blue Streak launcher, and it was going to be used for our independent satellites. And the Harold Wilson government just scrapped it. It wasn't worth the money. They had no vision of what space was about.
Well, what do you think we've actually lost as a country in following that route? I mean, some people argue that manned spaceflight is. Human spaceflight is in some sense sort of a childish luxury, very expensive waste of money that doesn't actually bring you very much. And, you know, previous science ministers in the UK, I'm thinking way back, have argued actually that in not doing that and in focusing on things like small satellites, the UK has actually been quite shrewd financially at least. But what do you think we've lost?
I think it's a lack of independence or direction in what the launcher capability. If you look at France's influence over its Arianespace and the Ariane launchers and how they are makes them a major player in the space industry, I don't think manned space programs have a relevance at the moment, and the independence the International Space Station is largely a very, very expensive luxury who only makes news stories when the toilets get clogged. But I still don't think Britain has the clout it has at the European Space Agency level because it doesn't invest the way that France and Germany does invest.
Do you think Britain, with its technology prowess, though, could really make a big impact in the emerging space nations, China, India? They're going to want to get up to speed quickly, and we've got the technology to get them there.
That's very possible, yes. And I'm unaware of what efforts we're doing, but I hope we are. I imagine that is a close thought to these guys. It's not. You've got to be very careful. It hasn't been 50 years of abject disaster. Many incredibly good probes have been built, and the good example being our involvement in Cassini-Huygens.
Giotto in the 80s, which was built by British Aerospace, I think, in Bristol, and flew through the tail of Halley's Comet, and was almost destroyed by the dust, but then managed to survive for several years later and fly through some other comets. I mean, that's an incredible science mission. And that was pure European. It wasn't even NASA. NASA decided not to get involved in that one. And looking to the future, there's going to be, you know, missions to Titan again, and possibly Europa, Ganymede, all these places. And John Zarnecki, who's a planetary scientist at the Open University, who was involved in Cassini-Huygens, I mean, one of our greatest raconteurs on this subject in this country.
Yes.
He was talking about how British scientists are involved in designing a boat that could float on the methane seas of Titan.
This is the Time mission that he's involved in.
That's right.
It's an incredible mission.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine anyone suggesting that 50 years ago?
I know. And the idea of the idea is you could surf on it because the methane seas on Titan will have these huge, slow. The gravity there is different, and the behaviour of methane there is, and you know, these very, very slow giant waves on it, and you could do a lovely slow motion surf on it.
Can you imagine? I hadn't even thought of that. Can you imagine holidays on Titan with fantastic surf spots?
Only -180 degrees.
just don't take any cigarettes, otherwise the sea could be a bit dangerous for a change. Just on the human spaceflight thing, actually, just as a coder, I suppose, I spoke to Piers Sellers, the British-born NASA astronaut who's a veteran of the Space Shuttle and International Space Station. He was trying to make the argument for Britain to get involved in human space flight. There is the inspiration angle, of course, the idea that if you've got people up there, your space program is more visible. So Italy, Spain, Germany, France, the US, of course, Russia, all these space programs have people at the front of them, and all the great science they do in the background is sort of brought up on the coattails of that. But here in the UK, we've just got the great science stuff, we've not got the people.
Yes.
And Piers Sellers was arguing, in fact, and this is quite controversial, he said that actually, from a science point of view, that the people are incredibly important. He said all of the stuff that the Mars rovers have done, Spirit and Opportunity, in 18 or however many years they've been up there, he said you could have done that in an afternoon with a person. Can you imagine the time it takes to communicate with those things, to pick up a pebble, go over there, come back, look at this other pebble, all of these time delays? An afternoon with a human being. And I thought, have you told your colleagues in the rover department? He sort of laughed. But he said he's been spending years trying to get British government involved in manned spaceflight. We can wind up this conversation in just a moment. What do you both think? Do you think Britain's going to send people into space at some point?
Well, we've got Tim Peake.
He's an ESA astronaut.
He's an ESA astronaut.
Not paid for by the UK.
And it's quite extraordinary that ESA, given that we pay nothing to the manned space program, ESA.
If he gets selected to go to the ISS,
he will be the first Brit in space, but it'll be an ESA money. It'll be exactly. So we will get, I imagine, a British astronaut. That's it. What did we get out of it? We don't get a lot of it, but I do kind of agree that a manned space program of some kind is both inspirational and probably necessary as well.
Ian?
I feel quite pessimistic about it, actually. I don't think it's going to be high priority. I think what the government will do is just focus on what it's doing in Harwell, which is an area in Oxfordshire where they're trying to build up what we sort of, with one eyebrow raised, called the UK Space Agency. But they are there building, you know, a lot of centres which should be doing a lot of the work for satellites. And I think we're going to stay on that train because it's where the government sees the money is. I don't think that's entirely... I don't think that's a problem, actually.
When the world sends people to Mars eventually in 20 or 30 years' time, it would be such a shame if on that roster of options there wasn't a Brit, don't you think?
I mean, we gave the world Dan Dare, for goodness sake. We should be there.
That's right. Well, let's leave it there. Let's hope that someone important in making decisions about this is listening and takes our carefully constructed arguments seriously and sends maybe Ian or Robin into space. For more or any of this stuff, please go to guardian.co.uk/science. Thank you both very much. There are more than 7 billion people living on Earth today. In some way, it shows the success of our species in the face of hunger and disease, though there's plenty of room for improvement in both those areas. But the world's increasing population also brings problems, specifically ecological ones. This week, the Royal Society published a report, People and the Planet. This brought together a working group of 21 experts from around the world under the stewardship of the biologist and Nobel laureate Sir John Sulston. The Guardian's environment editor John Vidal met Sir John to discuss the report's conclusions. He began by asking Sir John for a quick rundown of the report's main points.
What we conclude is that people have been leaving population off the agenda, but in particular what's been happening is that population and consumption have been treated separately. And let me immediately define consumption for these terms. We can consume economically, so that, for example, we can play games or write software or something. That takes little or no resource. Mm-hmm. Or we can consume materially, for example, digging up coal and burning it, driving our cars and so on. And it's the second sort of consumption that's of concern here, material consumption. And what's been ignored for the last 20 years is that this total material consumption is a product, essentially, of the number of people and the amount they each consume. I mean, it's not exactly a product because there are variations depending on the number of people. We can be something on the other side of the equation. But roughly speaking, it's the two multiplied together. And so we have to consider both. And we must not anymore get into the situation where one bunch of people in the world are saying it's all your fault because you're having too many babies. And the other side is saying it's all your fault because you're emitting too much carbon dioxide. Both, in a sense, are right, but both are certainly wrong if they don't bring those two observations together and say, what are we collectively going to do about it?
That's a very big global overview of the situation, but what your report shows very clearly is that there are some countries, especially the least developed countries, the 32 in Africa and elsewhere, where population pressures are still enormously high and have not come down. And you mentioned, for instance, Niger, where populations are doubling every 20 years. Now, these countries, presumably, is not about resources. This is about consumption. This is just about numbers. You need to get those numbers down. Are you saying that there is an urgency to stabilize numbers of populations?
Well, it would be enormously helpful. And having Elia Zulu from Nairobi, who is because of his position as director of the African Institute for Development Policy, is acutely aware of this and considers passionately that it's not a question of waiting for development to bring down fertility, but quite the reverse, that countries like Niger do need to reduce their fertility, reduce their family size, in other words, and increase the spacing of children in order to allow economic development to occur. Mm. So yes, in these cases, it's very clear that population is growing too fast for the resources available, and you know, people are stuck in a situation of dire poverty and indeed starvation, as we've seen recently with the droughts in the Sahel, unless the family sizes are reduced.
Mm-hmm. But you're not arguing, if I understand, you're not arguing that there's a one carrying capacity of the world or there is one optimum population size for the world.
The thing is, I mean, people are very welcome to define optimum population size, but each person will choose their own. It will depend entirely on the lifestyle assumptions they make, how many people is appropriate to support. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, in a certain sense, you can say, well, we need enough food for everybody, but then with enough technology, undoubtedly, you could grow more food. You know, if you sort of have hydroponics everywhere and so on, there's all sorts of things you could do. So if you can drive the numbers very high if you look at it in that way. Alternatively, you can say, look, I need so many square miles of wilderness myself, and if everybody takes that view, then of course the numbers will be very low. Mm-hmm. So you cannot say that one is right and the other's wrong. It's a choice.
But some people today, looking at the reactions immediately after it, some people are arguing, well, actually, the number of people is better. The more you have in a country, the more you can actually develop your economy. I mean, this is quite a good argument, isn't it?
It's a very popular argument, isn't it, I think it's the current mainstream school of economics that says that. It says that cities like New York, where people rub up against each other all the time, they quote the patenting rate, for example, of such a population. And I think the evidence is not good. I mean, for example, as far as that goes, I mean, the number of patents produced is not necessarily a good measure of serious innovation. Mm. It means that people are actually scared of each other and keep filing things in order to keep the others off their patch. So it's a kind of defensive way of doing it. Mm. So what I'm saying is that I think the evidence is limited, and it's certainly not obvious to me to anybody, I think, to be honest, that view is correct. So we do not have to be scared of having fewer people. And I mean, you know, if we want to look at very successful economies, like, for example, some of the Scandinavian countries, where the population is very sparse, and yet they're extremely innovative and have a very high quality of living. Mm.
On the other hand, you're getting people like Paul Ehrlich, who today are coming out and saying, well, actually, the optimum capacity of the world is 1.5 or 2 billion. And he says it's almost inevitable that we will cross that line, that threshold, when there will be no going back and disaster of one sort or another, a virus or nuclear war or something, will come and shrink numbers dramatically. I mean, you're presumably not of that order.
Well, our message is that that's exactly the situation we want to avoid. And by taking a forward look and taking the right policy decisions, which are not actually that hard, so long as they're taken in a long-term way and not drastically and suddenly, then we should be able to avoid those kind of catastrophes. Mm. But we certainly are saying, and that's of course why some of the commentators are already saying our report is gloomy and awful and miserable, it's because we're pointing to a need to readjust. We don't see it as a hair shirt report at all. Mm. We see it as an advice to use science and technology, but not to assume that that alone will deliver everything. We're saying science and technology must be based in a framework, to some degree a new framework. For example, we need to have an economic system that doesn't use our existing GDP measure that simply looks at the balance sheet, but it should also be pricing items you draw from the natural environment and damage you do to the natural environment. We should be pricing the effect of given actions on human well-being so that positive things, for example, get counted better than negative things and so on and so on. And we're saying if you embed science and technology in that framework, then you can have a really good result. Mm. What we're in disagreement with are the people who say, just let it all rip, the science and technology and very dense populations of people in cities will solve everything.
At this point, I asked Sir John about potential critics of the report. One of the most prominent is Matt Ridley, author of The Rational Optimist. He argues that population growth is not a problem. He says the rate of global increase has been falling for 50 years and in developing countries has nearly halved. Sir John Sulston is familiar with Ridley's work.
The thing is, optimism alone is not enough. I think he's not a rational optimist, personally. I think as he lays out his programme, he's an irrational optimist because he's saying, people on the market will take care of everything. I don't think that's for a moment. I mean, after all, I mean, if you look at the history of the financial services of this country, with which Matt was involved for a while, you can see very clearly that we need regulation in order to have an equitable life. We know that this recession was engendered through financial services that were not adequately regulated. Mm. We take it for granted that we regulate important things. One of my favourite little anecdotes or examples is air traffic control. Mm. It's taken for granted by everybody, even Matt Ridley, that you control where aeroplanes fly. Isn't that an enormous infringement of his human rights to fly his aeroplane wherever he wants? No, people accept because it's pretty bad when aeroplanes collide. It's not a certain death. So that's an easy one to sort of agree on. What's more difficult is to get agreement on the slow-burning, long-term issues, the ones we're talking about, where we can see problems down the line, but actually not in his lifetime or mine, probably, you know, not the real bad crash. We're looking at what will be for our children, children's children. Mm. And so I think we somehow have to move the sense that we do regulate in the short term, which we're beginning to learn, because it used to be people didn't even do that. Mm. And we're beginning to get that idea that we regulate in short term. And we've got to move that into these larger things. Mm. And you know what? I mean, one of the reasons, I think, for the disquiet of such people is that they don't really believe in the science, which is quite curious because, you know, Matt obviously is scientifically educated. They don't really understand or believe in, as I do, and I say believe, I mean, that sounds like I have faith. I don't mean that. What I mean is that I know now that because our observations are getting so extensive all over the Earth and the atmosphere, and because we're building such really good, elaborate models, it actually works. We actually could predict, it turned out, 20 years ago, what was going to happen to the Earth's temperature. And it's happening. You know, the models were right.
Thanks to Sir John Sulston and The Guardian's John Vidal. To see the report, go to the Royal Society website, royalsociety.org. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time at guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.